Before we begin, let's recite Surah Fatiha. Ask Allah to dedicate the thawab to all of the deceased from our families, our communities, our friends, the ulama who have left this world, the shuhada who have given their lives, especially those who have lost their lives in this blessed month of Ramadan. For all of them, Surah Al-Mubarakatul Fatiha, please. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين وشفيع المذنبين سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد والصلاة والسلام على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأسر والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وعجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم إلى الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam Imam Al-Hujjah One salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We first off begin by extending our condolences to our living and awaited Savior, Imam al-Hujjah, as we gather on this 19th day of the month of Ramadan to commemorate the day that the attack was launched against a commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And we offer our condolences to the Imam of our time and to all of the brothers and sisters who are here this evening to mark this tragic event in the calendar of Islam. Although the month of Ramadan is traditionally obviously looked upon as a favorable month, these are the days and nights as we mark the Layali al-Qadr, the nights of Qadr, the nights of grandeur, and those nights of an opportunity to get closer to Allah through prayer and supplication. But we also realize that it was in these days, in the year 40 after the Hijrah, 41 after the Hijrah, in the city of Kufa, that the successor to Rasulullah, the brother of the Prophet, the son-in-law, the cousin of Rasulullah, the one who was the first to believe in the message of Islam, it was on these nights and these days that he was fatally wounded in the Masjid of Kufa during the morning prayers, and that he eventually succumbed to his injuries 2 short days later. And so today, in memory of Amir al-Mu'mineen, I want to look at the topic of community building within the teachings of Amir al-Mu'mineen. But before that, as a brief preamble and introduction, when we look at Amir al-Mu'mineen, and all of us obviously identify as his followers, our identity is the Shia to Ali. When people say, or what we call ourselves the Shia, that is the abbreviated form, that is the shortened form. The full title is Shia to Ali. We are the followers of Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam. And this is not a title that we just arbitrarily made up. I don't want to go into all the specifics, but when you look at the earliest ahadith, the earliest sayings from Rasulullah, we have clear ahadith that all of the Muslims narrate, where Rasulullah would time and time again relate to Amir al-Mu'mineen that, O Ali, you and your Shia are the victorious ones. O Ali, you and your Shia are the ones who will be successful. This is a theme which Rasulullah emphasized many times where he used the term the Shia to Ali. And so when we take this label ourselves of being the followers, the Shia to Ali, this is something which is we have to appreciate is given to us by Rasulullah directly. And today we mark the death of this man, or at least the attack on this man, in which when you study his life, whether it be the early period when Islam was just a small fledgling religion in Mecca, or you look at his life in the post-Hijrah period in Medina, or you focus on the 25 years or 25 some odd years where he was deprived of the caliphate, and then you look at the last 4 or 5 years of his life when he becomes the caliph. Obviously, we accept that he was always imam, he was always our leader, but the open caliphate, the successorship which the community gave to him, that 4 or 5 year period, When we look at that entire period of his life, there's one thing which stands out. And ultimately, this is why he was killed in the mihrab. As a non-Muslim, as a Christian Lebanese had put it, that Ali was killed because of his intense desire to implement justice. When you look at his life, he wasn't killed because he prayed too much namaz. Right? The Khawarij had no problem with his salat. They didn't worry about his beautiful Quranic recitation. They had no problem with Ali as an abid, as worshipping Allah, of praying, of fasting, of engaging in acts of ibadah. They had no problem. And really the Muslim ummah on a whole, they never had a problem with Imam Ali alayhi salam as an abid, as a worshipper of Allah. When he taught Kumail, the famous dua of Kumail, he didn't create enemies from this dua. When he taught dua sabah that we recite in the mornings, he didn't create adversaries within the Muslim community. The real reason why Imam Ali was attacked in Masjid al-Kufa and why he eventually succumbed to those injuries was simply because of the fact he was a man of principles, a man who wanted to implement justice in every aspect of his life. To give you just one brief example of the level of justice that Amir al-Mu'mineen had, and there are many of them. If you read through Najul Balagha, and I would advise all of us, if we've never gone through Najul Balagha, to pick it up, go online, look it over. It's not written by Imam Ali. He didn't write this book himself. It was compiled by Sayyid Radhi, a great scholar of ours who is buried in Kadhimain, in which he compiled many of the statements, the letters, the sermons of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And in the collection of Nahjul Balagha, one of the sermons, Imam Ali alayhi salam, shows the level and the depth of the justice that he wanted to implement within society, which eventually he was killed because of this. And he talks about, he says in the example that were I to be given the entire kingdom to take a grain of rice from the mouth of an ant, I would not do that level of injustice. Imagine a man who is not willing to take a grain of rice or a leaf from the mouth of an ant, right? And he says, I could receive the entire world in terms of authority. He says, I'm not ready to do that. So when you have a man of that depth and that level of, you know, wanting to implement the rules of Allah on this earth, it stands to reason that people will come up in his way, and people will come up in the way of anybody who is at that level of depth and profundity of religion, that justice is their key implementation in their day-to-day life. In fact, when we look at the Quran, when Allah speaks about why he sent prophets, right? Sometimes people ask us, why did Allah send Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moses and Jesus and Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam? Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alim. Why did Allah send all of these prophets for humanity? Is it to teach us how to pray? We could have just set down a manual of how to pray with pictures in it. Is it to teach us how to go for Hajj, how to fast, how to do any of these actions? Obviously not. The Quran is clear that Allah tells us that we sent messengers, we sent guides. So Allah says, لِيُكُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْطِ, that people would base their lives on justice, on maintaining equality within the society. Ultimately, this was the struggle of Amir al-Mu'mineen, whether it be that pre-Khilafat period for the 21 some odd years that he was deprived of the right of leadership of the community, or that 4 years, or just little less than 5 years of becoming the caliph and the governor of the Muslim lands. All of it went back to all of his struggles, all of his difficulties were because of the fact of his implementation of justice. And justice basically meant for him to establish a community, establish a Muslim society, and for us to be mirror representations and mirror images of what he was trying to implement in his time that he had, that 4 or 5 short years. And so what I want to look at tonight is a brief expose on, in part one, and we'll continue in the nights to come, of what does Amir al-Mu'mineen speak about in terms of building a community from Najul Balagha. Again, this is a book which contains his letters, his sermons. It's a window into the mind of an intellectual man whom this world has never seen before. A mind, again, who, like even non-Muslims, write volumes, not just one or two books, Non-Muslim Christians write volumes about the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And when they analyze his life, you have books like the Lebanese Christian George Dordak, who writes a book entitled The Voice of Human Justice, Imam Ali. And he's just one in many different scholars from the non-Muslim tradition who have looked at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Tonight, I just want to look at one aspect of leadership and community building from the sermons and the statements of the Commander of the Faithful. And inshallah, as we continue, we will see how the Imam builds up on this topic within the other sermons of Nahjul Balagha. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. One of the first things that we see when we look at a community, of what it means to have an establishment, a community, is that we understand that a community is made up of individuals who share an ideology. They share a frame of thought. They share a way of life. They share many different things, and they relate together based on those things which they have shared in common. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam recognizes this, and he tells us at the very first level, when he was speaking to especially the Khawarij, those who had basically left Islam, who had been very simple-minded in their understanding. You know, when we look at Islamic ideology, we see that even in the Quran, Allah speaks about various groups of people. Right in Surah Baqarah, Allah talks about the Muslims, those who have taqwa, who have piety. He talks about the kuffar, the disbelievers who completely reject Allah and any notion about a God or any of the creeds that we believe in. And then Allah brings forth a third category, very unique, called the munafiqun. Hypocrites, people who believe one thing or who say one thing and believe another thing. They claim to be Muslims on the outside, but inside, as Allah describes them, where he says, in their hearts is a sickness, fi kulubihim maradun, fazadahum Allahu marada. And so Allah adds to that sickness within them. So Amir al-Mu'mineen al-Islam, when he was dealing with the Muslim community, he had all of these different groups to deal with. One group, or this group called the Khawarij. Now again, it's a lengthy discussion. I don't want to go into the intricacies of who the Khawarij were. But they became an ideology which is still around today, unfortunately, in many forms, where basically they completely misunderstood the religion, where they took context of verses of the Quran out of context. They took situations within the leadership out of context. And anybody who did not agree with their very shallow, very narrow-minded interpretation of Islam, they basically relegated them to be outside of the fold of Islam. And so once you designate somebody as outside of Islam, then you can basically do whatever you want with them. And this is what we saw, what happened to Amir al-Mu'mineen, and what even continues to happen today to believers around the world. And so this part of the khutbah of Nahjul Balagha, he was speaking to the Khawarij at one level, but also speaking to the community, the believers all in a whole. And he reminded them to be with the Imam of their time, to be with their leader. And he made the point to emphasize that a community has to be united together. We can't have factions. Now that doesn't mean that as a community, and even at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, that there would not have been ideological differences. We recognize the fact that there were people who had definitely been alive in his khilafat who did not necessarily accept him as the Imam, as the divinely appointed leader. They may have accepted his political authority, his political leadership, but they would have had serious issues with his imamat, so to speak. But his goal at this point was to gather the forces together, to gather the community together, regardless of where they stood in the political spectrum, to bring them under one banner, to bring them under one command, and for them to be able to work together as a global community. And this is something also that we see as we go on within our communities in the 21st century, that we live in a world today which is unlike probably any other time in history. You know, because of the way that the world has changed, because of immigration, because of so many different changes to the world, we realize that no longer are we just an individual group of one particular geographic background, one particular language, one particular ethnicity. Through all of these things that have happened around the world, through immigration, through refugees, crises, we have become a global community in the truest sense of that word. You know, there would have been a time And there probably still is a time in many parts of the world where they are only, their communities are only formed of one particular nationality. For example, you go to India or Pakistan or Afghanistan or Iraq, and you will find only a majority of people from those specific countries. You would have very few people from outside of their borders coming and forming a community within that particular country. But when we look at our situation, and I want to try to, you know, localize this to North America and Canada, we realize that we are a very unique community and we have a unique experience because we've never seen these kind of opportunities where multiple nationalities get together. This may have been, you know, there at the time of Rasulullah when he moved to Medina, and you had people like Salman come from Persia. You had companions from the Roman Empire. You had people from Africa. You had people from many other parts of the world gathering in Medina. But that would have been probably one of the few times in the Muslim history where you had such a community which was of multicultural and ethnicities and nationalities. One of the things, however, we see within Nahjul Balagha and also within the Quran, in the teachings of Amir al-Mu'mineen in his sermons, is the reality that as a community, we all have to be together. Again, regardless of whatever differences that we have. And our differences are very little compared to the commonalities that we have as a community of believers. And in fact, we have this interesting hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam himself, who says that surely no one, even though he may be rich, can do without his kinsmen, without his community, without his tribe. He says, and their support by their hands or their tongues. They alone are his support and can ward off the troubles from him. And they are the most kind to him when tribulations befall him. If we think about this for a minute, this is a real statement from Imam Ali alayhi salam. You know, we have times where people will drift away from the community. When something unfortunately will happen, they'll come to a center and somebody will insult them, somebody will say something to them, somebody will make fun of them, as has happened many times before, and that individual will boycott their particular center. They won't come to it, although it's the center of the imam, but still they will not even take part in the programs in that center. And at one level, we can't blame those individuals, because when you're treated with this disrespect in the house of Allah, it makes a person feel unwelcome. Even though it's not the fault of Allah or the Prophet or the Imams, it's the fault of the humans, the community people, but it still becomes a thorn in the side of that individual. But we realize that we have to obviously let those bygones be bygones and realize the importance of a community. You know, when we think about it, even though people may leave the community for months or years on end, but there are at least two events in their lives that they will always have to come back to a center. One is marriage, right? Whether we like it or not, when it comes to marriage, people always have to come back to the religious center, right? They always have to have it solemnized by a scholar, to have it legitimized, to have it within the community. So marriage has become one of the times where people drift back to the center. The other time is at death. Who can deny the fact that kullu nafsin dha'ikatul maut? Each and every single human being will face death. We will all taste the sweetness, or maybe for others the bitterness of death. But when death happens, eventually that individual has to come back to the religious center. At that point, they're carried to the center. When they were healthy, they could have come on their own. But when death comes, as we all realize, it happens to all of us, it will happen to all of us, that the center will become the focal point of that individual at that particular point in time. Unfortunately, that is in many cases too late. And Allah alludes to this in the Quran. In Surah 96, Surah Al-Alaq, Allah says a very beautiful passage. He says, "Kalla, innal insana la yatgha." He says, by no means, but look at every single human being. We become transgressors. We begin to transgress against our own selves. And then Allah says, أَرَآهُ اسْتَغْنَى. Allah poses a rhetorical question. He says, أَرَآهُ اسْتَغْنَى. Do you people think that you are needless of anybody else? Right? We all need people sometime in our lives. All of us need somebody. Whether it's at the time of a wedding, for example, At the time of a funeral, we have to have people to wash us, to give us the kafan, to carry our body to the grave, to bury us. We all need people at one time within our lives. And so Amir al-Mu'mineen makes it clear that no matter how rich we become, how powerful we become, how free we think we are, eventually we all need to come back to our communities, to come back to our base, and to come back to that realization that the community must be the focal point of our lives. Sallu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. And so as Amir al-Mu'mineen continues, he gives us some of our qualities. What are some of the qualities that Allah looks for or that are needed within a community? And literally this passage of the Quran, which is repeated so many times, becomes a blueprint for our own progression. This is a theme Allah repeats many times, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. Those who believe and who act in a righteous fashion. Belief at one level is, as we know, not just saying I believe, because as Allah would tell the Prophet in the Quran, the A'rab, the desert Arabs, would come to Rasulullah and say, Amanna, we believe, as Surah Hujurat mentions. Allah would tell the Prophet, tell those people, you don't believe, walakin kulu aslamna. Don't say that you believe, because belief is a level above, but just say you have submitted. And so one of the first criteria that we're looking for in a community that is moving forward and trying to prepare for the return of the 12th Imam is a community of people who not only say that they believe, but they actually have that commitment within their heart. That commitment to practice the religion, to follow the teachings that have been laid down. And Iman, as we know, when we look at even Amir al-Mu'mineen, one of his titles is that, Amir al-Mu'mineen. The commander, the prince of the people of Iman, the prince of the faithful. And so when we look at ourselves as the Shia to Ali, as I mentioned in the beginning, we have to look at our lives and see, am I a mu'min? Am I a believer? If I am a believer, at what level of Iman am I at? You know, there's a very famous hadith that Rasulullah tells us that Iman, faith, has different gradations, different levels, different stages of Iman. And Rasulullah said that Salman al-Muhammadi was at the 10th level of Iman. Well, we all know Salman, what a great Sahabi he was. And at the same time, Rasulullah says Abu Dharr, a very great companion as well, was at level number 9 of Iman. But the difference between that one level is so pronounced that we are told in the hadith that if Abu Dharr, who was at level 9, knew what was in the heart of Salman at level 10, the hadith clearly says he would have either killed Salman or called him a kafir, that you apostated from religion. So Iman is a very intricate aspect. It's not, you know, we are mostly, all of us are born, or many of us, if not all of us, are born into Islam. And we take on the title of Iman. But if you read and study the ayat and the hadith about Iman, we realize that it's not just a little passport or a card that we're born with, but that Iman takes on many different ways and many different levels of understanding. But we have to realize that once we come into the religion and we're Muslims, Iman is now the second level that we have to strive to attain. If we want to be called the followers of Ali, who is the leader of the believers, then we have to look at ourselves with a critical eye and see what level of Iman am I at? Am I at a level that Amir al-Mu'mineen would accept me as his follower? Or am I just calling myself a follower of Amir al-Mu'mineen without there being a reciprocation from the commander of the faithful? Iman also means that we are committed. So it's Iman is belief in the heart, as the hadith says, but then actions, putting it into practice, right? Walking the walk, talking the talk, claiming the religion, and then actually living the teachings within our day-to-day life. Now obviously we're not expected to become religious overnight. It is a constant struggle and battle. But as we see even in the Quran, that, and we see also in the hadith, that we learn and we have to practice what we learn. You know, sometimes some of the youth would come to our grand Maraja Taqleed and they would ask the Maraja, teach us some hadith, you know, hadith that we've never heard of before. And Maraja would reply back to them that, rather than looking for hadith that you've never heard of, take the hadith that you know, that you have in the books, and implement those in your life. When you can follow the basics, when you can take Mafatihul Janan, for example, and read the du'as, and change because of the content of the du'a, then come and ask for more. So it's not about taking all of the knowledge in at one time, it's about taking bit by bit, piece by piece, like a jigsaw puzzle, and implementing what we know, and then working on that which we don't know, and try to get to that level of implementation of further teachings within the religion. This verse also shows us, not only is it about belief and being committed to the religion, but it's also about being just and balanced in Islam. And this is where many people fail. Many people become one of the two extremes, either ultra-religious, which is a problem in Islam, or ultra-secular and ultra-irreligious, and where they completely leave the religion. When Rasulullah brought Islam, he taught it as a balanced religion. There are many traditions where he would tell the people, he would warn the Muslims about extremism in religion, about being extreme in praying, extreme in worship, extreme in giving charity. And he warned us, don't go to those extremes in religion. Be a balanced individual. Be moderate in the religion. Practice it, but be moderate in the way that we implement and we learn the religion of Islam. And the last aspect of this verse is one of knowledge. Now this is a thing I've talked about in the past, but just to refresh our memory, knowledge is really the key of success in our Islam. You know, we mentioned in the past that some people have this belief that ignorance is bliss. If I don't know something about religion, it's much better for me because I can do what I want and I can claim on Day of Judgment, well, I didn't know better Allah. But we've talked about in the past, and I'll repeat this one point only, that knowledge of Islam actually frees us. It makes following Islam a much easier religion to follow. You know, when I look at the book of my marja and I follow his rules, and he tells me, for example, that when you live in a non-Muslim society and you interact with people who you don't know their religion, that you don't question them about their religion. You shake their hand if it's a person of the same gender. Obviously, for food, there are separate issues, but even that, our maraja have made it very easy to follow. You look at the rulings of Sayyid Sistani as an example. And he shows us, when you take in the knowledge of the religion, even if you want to go out for food at a restaurant, it doesn't make it impossible that you have to ask 1,000 questions. Who is the cook? Did they touch it? What are the ingredients? He says none of these things are required. You don't have to ask. Yes, meat is a different issue about slaughtering. But generally speaking, he says, don't ask the religion of the person. Don't even ask if they've touched the food with their wet hands. Go and eat and enjoy life. Don't be too deep into the religion in these aspects. So it shows us that when we have knowledge of Islam, when we look at the book of our marja and we follow the rules, that knowledge makes our life much easier to navigate through. We're not worried and we're not going in all of these different challenges of how I will navigate around in my day-to-day life. And so knowledge becomes the key for many of the actions that we can follow. And knowledge becomes one of the tools for us to become better at following the religion of Islam. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Coming to another aspect, and we'll conclude with this portion, is that when Amir al-Mu'mineen looks at the ideal Muslim community, how to build a community, again, he was building this in his time. And this is ultimately why he was killed. He was killed because of his trying to change society to make it a community of believers and of practicing people who are following the dictates of Islam. He looked at the aspect of a community from two different portions. He looked at the adherents, the people who formed the community, and how committed they were to following the teachings that he had been given and that were coming to him from Rasulullah. And he was also looking at the aspect of the leaders of the community. And when you look at this and you study and reflect on the sermons of Najul Balagha, where he repeats many of these, we see that these two ingredients become integral for the development and the continuation of any community. And when we look at them, we see that there are actually two aspects. When you have the leaders and the followers, they have rights upon one another, but they also have obligations. And this is how Islam itself is as a religion. You know, just to give us one practical example. Today, if you have one man and one woman, they're not married, they're not brother and sister, they're just two total strangers. Islamically speaking, they don't have many rights or responsibilities above one another. They're just two strangers in the midst of an entire society. But that man and that woman, they recite the Aqd of Niqah, they become married, they're now husband and wife, and the entire scenario changes. Now, when they're man and woman as husband and wife, now the man is obligated to take care of the wife, to pay for her food, her clothing, her shelter, to maintain her at a standard that she was accustomed to when she was with her mother and father. So before marriage, he had no obligations over the woman. They become husband and wife, and now the entire situation changes. The wife now obviously has also responsibilities over the husband. She has rights over the husband. She also has responsibilities she needs to maintain. And we see that this changes the entire dynamic. When we build a community we work together to build a Muslim community and society, when we realize that we have two different strata, we have the leaders and we have the community members, we realize also that there is a give and take in that scenario. The leader, as Amir al-Mu'mineen would show, and I'll give us just one or two examples tonight, the leaders have rights over their followers. But that same leader is also obligated to fulfill obligations he has over the community. And the followers also have certain rights over the leaders and also things that they have to do. So ultimately, the way that Amir al-Mu'mineen was describing this was that as a community, everybody has a role to play. They're all stakeholders in the entire community. And if one of the two sides is not putting the weight into it, or they're not fulfilling their side of the bargain, then basically that is where we have a dysfunctional community. That's where you have people who may follow the same religion, follow the same customs, follow the same norms, but you can't call them a community in the truest sense of that word. They're just individuals who live and maybe function and maybe make one or two prayers together. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So there are three things. I'm just going to look at one aspect tonight and we'll conclude. Is that Amir al-Mu'mineen looks at it from three different perspectives. You have one area which are shared values, where he talks in Najul Balagha and the Quran also speaks about shared values between the leader and the people who are the followers. Certain things are common between the both of them that they have to all maintain, which is what I'll look at tonight. And then sometimes there are certain responsibilities that the leadership has, which they need to fulfill to the community. And also, and we look at this in the nights to come, that the responsibility of the followers, what do the people of the society have to give back to the leaders in order for that community to be a functional, successful society. And again, a society that is built upon this understanding of the return of our 12th Imam. And that we are gathering and working together to bring something about that can actually assist the 12th Imam when he begins that movement, that he will be able to look to these communities who have built themselves on a foundation, and that they can be ones who the Imam would be able to integrate into his entire system. The one value I want to look at tonight is that of taqwa. Taqwa is a thing that I've probably spoken about in the past. For those who come to the Friday prayers, you know that it is an obligation, it is wajib on the speaker of the Friday sermon to always advise the community about taqwa. In fact, even our Maraj, like Ayatollah Sistani, he makes it clear that when it comes to the Friday sermon, it is wajib on the speaker to advise the community about taqwa. And not only in Arabic, he says if the community majority speak another language other than Arabic, he says it is an obligation on the speaker to advise the community to taqwa and to speak about taqwa in their language, in their tongue. So taqwa really becomes the basis of our entire life. Again, so it becomes the basis of our Friday prayers, it becomes the basis of every aspect of our lives. But what is taqwa? In Jummah, we try to explain it, we try to give a meaning of what this word is about. Literally, however, the word taqwa comes from the word wiqaya, which means like a shield, something to protect ourselves with. In the context of Islam, it means to protect ourselves from the displeasure of Allah, from earning the punishment of Allah. Now, how does that come about? How do you, you know, on a practical level, how do we understand taqwa? It becomes a challenge because really everything in our life should be based on the criteria of taqwa. Every action that a person does, every action that we want to do, everything that we say, it needs to be based on the model of taqwa. That is this going to be a protection from me from the fire of hell? Is what I'm about to say going to lead me into heaven or hell? Is what I'm about to do going to lead me into heaven or hell? Every action, every thought, every speech, when preceded by the shield of taqwa, would hopefully help us to be able to control ourselves, to be able to give us a bit of a guide in life of how to lead our lives. The Quran, you know, before I go to the one hadith from Najib Balagha, when we look at the Quran about taqwa, out of the hundreds of ayat, there are two that I just want to point out. Two different criteria or qualities that Allah gives about taqwa. In one verse of the Quran where Allah speaks about taqwa, He talks about it as being a clothing. Right? Just like we wear pant and shirt, we wear this clothing that to protect ourselves, to cover ourselves up. Allah says, وَلِبَاسُ taqwa ذَلِكَ khair. He tells us that the clothing of taqwa is the best form of clothing. A clothing of piety, where it's not about the physical clothing, but it's about being aware of Allah. Where it's about always being in that knowledge of being in the presence of Allah. And just as clothing protects us from the elements, clothing in the winter, we wear winter clothes, it protects us from the elements. In the summer, we change our clothes. This similar understanding is there within the Quran. Also, Allah talks about taqwa where He says, وَتَزَوَّدُوا فَإِنَّ خَيْرَ زَادِ taqwa. And prepare yourself, prepare your provisions for a journey. And Allah says the best provision is that of taqwa. You know, just as you and I, when we travel, we'll pack a suitcase, we'll have our passport, we'll have our vaccinations, everything that we need to go on the journey, we pack everything beforehand. Allah says the best provision that you can pack for the akhirat, for the world to come, is that of taqwa. It's to have that consciousness and awareness of Allah within our lives, that we're able to move forward with this provision of taqwa. When Amir al-Mu'mineen will speak about taqwa in Najul Balagha, and he gives many different sermons and he gives different examples. We have, for example, even the khutbah of Hammam about what is the muttaqi. In one of the examples, Imam Ali would tell us that taqwa is like riding a horse. Now, obviously, we don't unfortunately ride horses in today's day and age. Probably the closest we'll get is watching the Calgary Stampede and riding horses there. But Amir al-Mu'mineen would say that a person who has no taqwa, it's like you put yourself on a horse, which is a wild horse, hasn't been tamed, and you don't have the reins of the horse in your hand. And so when you don't have taqwa, you're basically riding a wild beast. You're riding the dunya, and wherever the world will take you, you'll go in that direction. Because when you have no consciousness of Allah, when you don't have the taqwa, then anything that comes, you'll go to that way. Just like that wild horse would take the person wherever it wants to go. But then Amir al-Mu'mineen says, if you have taqwa, it's like you're controlling that horse. You've got the reins of that horse in your hand, or you're on a domesticated horse, and it takes you towards felicity. It takes you towards the right path. And so Amir al-Mu'mineen gives these sorts of examples and many more in Najul Balagha. Again, we have the khutbah of Hammam, and when Hammam hears the description of the muttaqi, we're told that he dies instantly on the spot. The words of Imam Ali affected him to such a level that he literally died after hearing the khutbah of Mawla. And so when we see these sorts of hadith in Najul Balagha and many other traditions, we understand the fact that taqwa is something that has to be cultivated within our lives. It has to be built upon, it has to be developed and nurtured, and it has to be something that we use to control ourselves, to control our desires, and control our instincts. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. In another hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, we're coming to a close before I just mention a few words about his shahada tonight, is where he tells us the importance of this trait, although the entire community needs to have taqwa. The believers have to have taqwa. The common people have to have taqwa. But how he stresses it on the leadership of a community, of a society. And he tells us that a person who puts himself up or herself up as a leader for society, that it is more incumbent upon them to establish taqwa within themselves before they go and train other people. It's more important for them to be people of piety before they go and tell other people. This is something the Quran speaks about so many times. Allah tells us, for example, أَتَأْمُرُونَ النَّاسَ بِالْبِرِّ وَتَنْسَوْنَ أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَنْتُمْ تَتَلُونَ الْكِتَابِ. Allah says that do you advise people to goodness, to righteousness, and you forget your own self, your own soul, while you read the book, while you read the Quran? And so Allah tells us so many times, time and time again, that we have to work on ourselves. And once we work on ourselves, then we can work on the rest of the society. And this is something Amir al-Mu'mineen did at many stages of his life. Eventually, after he became the Khalifa and he took on the leadership of the society, we know that he began to remove people who had been appointed by the previous Khulafa. And he would appoint new people in their place. But one of the interesting things and one of the realities of Amir al-Mu'mineen is one of the people he appointed to governorship in Basra, a man called Uthman ibn Hunayf. From the apparent point of view, he was a follower of Imam Ali, a Shia to Ali. He was respected by the commander of the faithful. He had a level of dedication to Islam. He was committed to Amir al-Mu'mineen's teaching. So Imam Ali put him in charge of Basra. But one of the shortcomings that this man had, and many people have, right, because they're not masoom, they lead their life by whatever comes forth, is that this man made a serious blunder in his dealings with the community in Basra. And what he ended up happening to do is that he was invited to the houses of the rich and the famous people of Basra. And Amir al-Mu'mineen found out. He found out one of his governors was taking invitations at the homes of the rich and famous, sitting at tables of massive buffets of food, while the poor people were not given a chance to be in those gatherings, where the simple people of Basra were not invited to those gatherings. And so Imam Ali tells Uthman ibn Hunayf in a letter which is recorded in Najul Balagha. And it's a lengthy letter, but just the one portion. Imam Ali told him that, "I didn't think that you would be like this kind of a person. I thought you would have some level of taqwa, some level of piety, that you would have thought about your actions." Because he's saying that you're the leader and people expect more from the leader of the society. People expect the leaders to be at the level of the most vulnerable of the society. And so Imam Ali in the letter, he told Uthman, and I'll conclude with this point tonight. He says that, "I expect you to be like Ali, eat two simple foods a day." But Imam Ali says, "I know that you can't do that." Imam Ali tells you and I know that we as Muslims, as his followers, that we today in the 21st century, we cannot live the life of Ali. You know, he was the man who, when he would break bread for iftar, he would break it on his knee. He would eat rock solid bread for iftar. Right? Maybe he would dip it in water to soften the bread a bit. We can't do that. He would wear old clothing. He would stitch up his shoes. You know, today our shoes rip. We go buy a brand new pair. We don't think twice. Amir al-Mu'mineen would sew his sandals, which had no value. He wouldn't waste the money of the public treasury. He wouldn't even use his own money because he knew that people in his kingdom had less than what he had. And so he tells Uthman, he goes, "You can't do what I do. Don't pretend or try to be like me." He says, "But at least support me. You know, try to show that you are with the people. Try to be upright, chaste. Try to be somewhat of an example that I am within the community." And as we conclude tonight, as we mark this night where we commemorate the attack against Amir al-Mu'mineen, we too realize that we cannot be like Ali. We have those t-shirts that people sometimes wear, "Live like Ali and die like Hussein." And ultimately, really, if you and I were to study the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, if we were to go through Nahjul Balagha and see what kind of a life Imam Ali alayhi salam led, we would definitely say that we cannot live a life like Ali. Because again, who could be like Ali to eat dry bread that's so hard? He had to break it on his knees. Who can be like Ali to go through the difficulties that he did, to see his wife being attacked, not only verbally attacked, but physically attacked in her own house, and put up with all of the challenges because of the promise he made to Rasulullah that he would not raise a sword, even though Lady Zahra alayhi salam would be killed eventually. Who can be like Ali to have that kind of sabr, to see his wife die in front of his eyes and be patient in front of all those tribulations? Brothers and sisters, as we commemorate the tragedy of the Dharbat on Imam Ali alayhi salam, we take ourselves back to the city of Kufa. But even before what happened in Kufa on the 19th day of the month of Ramadan, let me just give you a brief synopsis as a lead up to what happened to cause the Amir al-Mu'mineen's attack on the 19th of Ramadan. As we know, when Imam Ali took over the Khilafat for those 5 short years, year after year he fought battle after battle. 1 year was a battle with Muawiyah in Sham. 1 year was a battle of Jamal against the Umm al-Mu'mineen, the wife of Rasulullah. And eventually one other battle was faced against the Khawarij. At each and every one of these battles, the people were working against Imam Ali time and time again. Not only at the physical level of these wars and attacks, but even at a psychological level and at a propaganda level. Eventually, it was in the month of Dhul-Hijjah. Hujjaj had gone to Mecca to perform the Hajj. The curse Ibn Muljim, the one who would later on kill Amir al-Mu'mineen, him and his friends from the Khawarij had gathered around the Kaaba in the holy city of Mecca. They were sitting and talking about the state of the Muslim Ummah. And eventually they hatched a plan. They said that there are 3 people in the Muslim Ummah that if we can get rid of these 3 individuals, then we can put the Muslim community back on track. There were 3 people that they had planned to kill. They made a plan that on the 19th of Ramadan at Fajr time, that 3 different individuals would go to 3 locations to kill 3 people. The first person that they would kill was Umar As, who was the governor of Muawiyah based in Egypt. One of these people went towards Egypt to kill him on the 19th of Ramadan. Another individual said, I'll go and kill Muawiyah in Sham. And so the second individual dispatched to Sham. And the third, that was the one that we're looking at tonight, this evening, is Amir al-Mu'mineen and his killer, Abdul Rahman ibn Muljim Mal'un, that he had made a promise, he had made a pact that he would go and kill Amir al-Mu'mineen. Now keep in mind that Ibn Muljim was not a normal individual. He was a man whom Sheikh Abbas al-Kummi mentions in Muntaha al-A'mal. He mentions that the same Abdul Rahman ibn Muljim who would kill Imam Ali, that he fought with Imam Ali in the Battle of Nahrawan. He fought with Imam Ali in the Battle of Jamal. He fought with Imam Ali against Muawiyah. What would have happened to this cursed individual that within that short period of time, fighting on the side of Amir al-Mu'mineen, that now he turns his vendetta and vengeance against Amir al-Mu'mineen? Eventually he makes his way to Medina early before the month of Ramadan. And as he's going around the city, he's planning and plotting his revenge against the commander of the faithful. Eventually his eyes are set on a beautiful woman, we're told, in the city of Kufa. She was a woman who had her family killed by Amir al-Mu'mineen in previous battles. And so she had a vendetta for Amir al-Mu'mineen also to be killed. Abdul Rahman ibn Muljim meets this woman. And instantaneously, as he falls in love with her, he asks for her hand in marriage. She says, I'll marry you on one account, that you give me the dowry, the mahar that I want. What was the dower this woman wants? She says, I want X amount of gold coins. I want a certain number of servants. Abdul Rahman ibn Muljim says, no problem, I'll give you however much money you want. I'll give you the servants if you want that. And then she says, the third part of my mahar, I want the head of Ali ibn Abi Talib. She says, I want the head of Ali given to me, and this will be my mahar, and I'll allow you to marry me. Brothers and sisters, Abdul Rahman ibn Muljim, he takes the words of this lady and he says, I will fulfill your promise. He says, I'm waiting for the opportune time on the 19th of Ramadan. I will go and kill I will kill Ali ibn Abi Talib, and I'll bring his head to you. As we're told, on that night on the night that Amir al-Mu'mineen would have that fatal attack, it was the 19th of the month of Ramadan. Amir al-Mu'mineen, as was his tradition in Kufa, that he would spend one night with each of the family members of his family. One night he would be at the house of Imam Hassan having iftar. One night at the house of Imam Hussein. One night with Bibi Zainab and her family. one night with Ummu Kulthum. It just so happens that this night, on the 19th morning, on the night of the 19th, that Amir al-Mu'mineen was scheduled to be at the house of his daughter Ummu Kulthum. He goes to the house, he offers his namaz, he finishes the namaz and he sits down at the sufra to have his iftar. His daughter comes and she lays the food onto the tablecloth. When Imam Ali looks at the food, he sees that there's a pitcher of milk. He sees there's just two pieces of barley bread, and he sees a small container of salt. He calls his daughter towards him, and he says to his daughter, he says, "Oh, my daughter," he says, "I never could have realized that you could have been so unfair to your father in terms of the iftar." The young lady is confused. What can she say? She says, "Oh, father, what do you mean? What have I done to make you upset?" He says to her, "That you know that as long as I have been alive, as long as I've been with Rasulullah, that I would never break my fast with more than two things at the table. You have brought me milk, you've given me a bit of salt, and there's a bit of bread. Please take one of these things away." We're told that she takes one of the three things away, and Imam Ali breaks his iftar. He has his iftar with whatever meager remains are there at the table. And all through the night, we're told that Imam Ali makes his way in and out of the house. He'd go into the courtyard of the house, he would look up into the stars, he would begin to recite of the ayat of the Quran, he would begin to remember the promise that his Habib Rasulullah gave to him, that his death would be happening in this night of Ramadan. He would go back into house, the family would ask him, "Oh father, why do you go back and forth into the house?" And he says, "I'm waiting for that time that my Habib has promised that would come to pass." Eventually, brothers and sisters, as the time for Fajr becomes closer and closer, as the time for the adhan becomes closer and closer, Imam Ali begins to make his way from the house. He makes his way towards Masjid al-Kufa. At that point, we're told as he enters Masjid al-Kufa, he sees Ibn Muljim, who's waiting there in line to kill Amir al-Mu'mineen. Imam Ali makes his way towards the minaret to give the adhan. Sheikh Abbas al-Kumi says that as Imam Ali begins to give the adhan, as he begins to proclaim, "Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar," he says that not a single house in Kufa is there except that they hear the voice of Imam Ali reverberating within their house. He continues with the entire adhan. He finishes the adhan and makes his way into the mihrab. Scholars say that he begins to recite his nafila prayers. He completes the nafila. Eventually, he begins to begin the Salatul Fajr, the two rakat Fajr namaz. He begins to finish his first rakat. He's in the sajda of the first rakat. We're told that as Imam Ali is coming up from the sajda, that part where we have all of our strength, when we're coming up with force from the sajda, that Abdurrahman ibn Muljim Mal'un, he runs towards Amir al-Mu'mineen. He takes a sword out of the sheath, the poison sword, and he strikes on the head of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He strikes on the forehead of Imam Ali in the same spot that he had been injured in the battles many years back. Imam Ali begins to scream from the pain of the attack. He begins to say, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." He remembers that verse of the Quran. He remembers that from the earth we have been created, and back to the earth we will go, and to Allah we will return. He mentions that sentence, that "Fustu bi Rabbil Kaaba," that by the Lord of the Kaaba I have been successful. Brothers and sisters, as Imam Ali is bleeding from his head, his face is being covered in his blood, his beard is being drenched in his blood, what can he do? He calls Imam Hassan. Imam Hassan leads the namaz, he finishes the Fajr namaz in Jamaat. At this point, as Imam Ali is in the mihrab of the Masjid al-Kufa, bleeding profusely, the people run to gather and to capture Ibn Muljim. They bring Ibn Muljim back to Imam Ali. Even at this point, brothers and sisters, even though Imam Ali has been suffering this injurious wound and he's bleeding from the top of his head, he still tells the family to maintain justice with Ibn Muljim, to make sure that the rope around his hand isn't too tight. Even at this critical point in time, Imam Ali does not give up his quest for human justice. Eventually, as the morning of the 19th will continue, Imam Ali is taken back to his house. He's taken to his house and put in his bed, in which he will lie for the next few days as he suffers the poison that goes through his body, and as he begins to suffer the attack of the curse Ibn Muljim and the poison sword that hit the head of Amir al-Mu'mineen.